Ladies and gentlemen, boys and ghouls, to all of our non-binary friends, to everyone on the spectrum and in between, welcome back to another episode of The Shudder Show. My name is Ken Stachnik, and with me, as always, is...
David Marlowe.
David, how are you doing today?
Ah, Ken, you sweet sugar tits, I am doing just fine and dandy like sour candy. How about yourself, sir?
I am fit as a fiddle and ready for love, sir. I am excited to be back. It has been a little while. We apologize. We have had some things going on in our personal spaces that have prevented us from recording, but it is that spooky season. So we are back. We are going to be doing our best to bring you one week after another of Halloween spooky, scary bangers. And we have our very first spooky banger. And that one is the 2020 film, The Stylist. Directed by Jerifar Gingin. I think I got that right.
Yeah. Let's. So Ken, you think it's pronounced
Jafar Jay-Z? Jafar Jay-Zian.
Jafar, which, by the way, super talented filmmaker, and I'm totally not making fun of her. But every interview I've seen her with, everyone is like, "Now tell me if I'm pronouncing this right. It's this," and she goes, "Close enough."
Mm-hmm.
Like, she interviews very well, by the way. Like, she seems absolutely delightful. And I'm so sad that of all the people we've interviewed so far, she could not be added to that list. Because I tried reaching out to our contact at one point to see if she was at all represented. And unfortunately, she is not.
Well, I mean, that is a bummer. But I mean, give us time. Maybe we'll get a chance to talk to her. Hey, out there in the Twitterverse, if you want to throw a shout out to Jill and see if she wants to talk to us, we'd be glad to do that. But let's see here, David, before we get into the movie question, how have you been? How you doing?
You know, Ken, a little exhausted. We've been away for a long time, more kind of with having to do with things on my end. It's just going from one job to the other. You move out here thinking a job's going to be one thing. And then turns out they sold you a box of sawdust that has nothing in it other than something that's just going to clog up your lungs and not be good for you.
JJ's so I moved mystery on. Box, if you will.
Exactly. It's like a JJ Abrams mystery box. Everyone thinks it's going to be good. And then it just turns out to be a complete and utter shit. So, you know, moved on to another job, had to adjust to that one for a little while before I could even entertain recording a podcast. But no, I am happy to be back. It is, you and I have been, catching up as often as we can, just staying friends and, making sure that connection never gets lost.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Oh, what's you okay there, buddy?
Yep. No. Microphone's just moving a little bit on me. So I'm just trying to,
it's a ghost.
Absolutely thrilling podcast material right here.
There was a great video that I saw not too long ago. This dad had his daughters playing with a Ouija board for a sleepover. And so he goes down into the basement where the breaker is for their bedroom. And then he just starts switching the light on and off. And you just hear all these girls screaming their heads off above him.
That is a good dad. That is a good dad right there.
Oh, can't wait for fatherhood. One day. So Ken, what made you, because this was a film that was, ultimately your choice. I think you were the one that brought it to our attention. What made you want to watch this film and do an episode on it?
There was so much about this movie that I wanted to talk about, and I wanted to make sure that people out there got a chance to see it if they hadn't seen it already. And if you have seen it, I guess we're going to kind of spoil it, although this is the kind of movie that I would say like is kind of hard to spoil. You're kind of pretty sure you know where it's going from the beginning. And what's really fun is watching it play out. And while it does things I have seen before, it does. I've never seen them all done like this before. And I've never seen them.
Like a slow motion train. Like,
Yeah, I mean, there's like so much. There's so much to appreciate here. I mean, if nothing else, the cinematography is absolutely gorgeous. The production design, the costumes, the color, the look of this film is absolutely like just sumptuous. It has got all of the style that you would expect coming from someone who is a hairstylist. There is someone who as a fashion photographer worked around the hair industry. There's a lot of this that I know is going to ring true for anyone who's ever worked in the hair or in the beauty worlds. There's so much in the style that I love. There's other horror movies that this is crediting. And then I think also, not only do we have a female director, we have a female star, we have an almost all female cast. We have like one guy who's kind of like hanging around. And in some scenes, you don't even see his face. Like there's like one whole scene where we just stay with our lead actress, who we should say is Najara Townsend, who gives just a fantastic performance. And she's someone I hadn't seen before. So, I mean, getting introduced to her was incredible. I know. And also, this is a movie that I want to make sure people are talking about, because this movie got finished in February of 2020. And so
so the best time to be finishing your first feature film.
Absolutely the best of luck to get it done before the lockdowns, but also then the realization that the film festival run that you thought you were going to have and deserved and got was going to be online, which for a movie based on a short that I think was done in 2016, when you are an up-and-coming director and you are thinking about, when I make my feature film, this, it's all going to be worth it because I'm going to, you know, because this experience, and then you get it, but you get this pandemic version. I mean, this movie, this played at Sitges, this won Best Actress at Fright Fest. It got released on Arrow. It's got a beautiful Blu-ray.
It's got a solid 90. It still sits with a solid 90% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, it's got great reviews, and I'm just not seeing people talk about this movie. And so I wanted to talk about this movie from the first whispers that I had started hearing about it from its early festival run. This was a movie to pay attention to and to keep an eye on. And Jill Jevargentian is, I think, somebody we're going to see a ton more from in the future.
I really hope so. I agree. And Ken, this isn't usually, and you know what, this is, no, that's a lie. Like I was going to say, this isn't usually my go-to in terms of style, but it is, I don't know. It's so interesting because when I was watching this, I got serious May vibes, and then come to realize that May is one of her favorite films, and she 100% bases a lot of her style and a lot of her I'm watching just Ken just slowly adjust this. Looks like him trying, just looking at the mic at my wedding as it slowly
I'm doing my best here
for the non-video listeners here. Ken's mic is just slowly dwarfing him in his shot.
Sorry.
But no, this gave me some serious Lucky McGee May vibes. And that is apparently one of her favorite films. And she says that this film, she wanted it to be this weird in terms of like inspiration. She wanted to be like an amalgamation of like Texas Chainsaw meets May, which fucking spot on first off. But like May was one of those movies where the cover always grabbed me when I was at the video store, but I never bothered checking it out, didn't know what the fuck it was. And it was kind of forced upon me at the Music Box Massacre in Chicago. Around Halloween every year, they do the Music Box Massacre, and it's a 24-hour horror film festival. It's the greatest thing on the planet. But it's one of those cases where that movie popped out of nowhere, and it turned out being my favorite movie of that whole festival. It was such a surprise hit with me. And I think the stylist is 100% that kind of movie. And I think it would be that for a lot of people who haven't seen it. It doesn't hit quite as much of the gore aspect that that May has. May has some real shocking shit that goes on there. But The Stylist has, as its name describes, a certain style to it that I think immediately grabs people, keeps them locked in, and like actually makes them care about the, gives them the whole the sympathetic psychopath situation that you see from like movies like Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, and Maniac.
Well, at least where they make you as sympathetic to the character, I think, as you could be, because like as we said in our coverage of Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, I don't know if it's sympathetic. I understand where the man is coming from more, but I don't. Mm-hmm. I'm not feeling for the man for sure.
Oh no. And I think in this particular case, but like when she talks about like Texas Chainsaw and Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, there's several interviews where she does discuss these films and what fascinates her with them is that she thinks back to stories where you hear about somebody doing something horrific and your immediate, you know, lizard brain thought is, oh yeah, that sounds terrible. This person should be locked up. This person, or like it makes people go, oh, I'm so glad this person got executed or whatnot. It's interesting that society focuses more on them before they've committed these acts, as opposed to society helping them when they needed the help to prevent the act from even happening. If that makes sense. And she's like, that's where the sympathy really comes in mind with The Stylist, because you can tell that she genuinely doesn't quite know what's wrong with her. She's so like this is mental illness at its worst, but like also it comes from like her feeling that her thoughts and her inability to socialize is just slowly killing her. That's kind of the vibe that I grab from her.
I mean, I think a big chunk of it, I think, is she identifies so much as being a stylist, and so much of when you think of going and getting your hair done, so much of that is being that social, talky, gossipy, and not necessarily in a bad way, but that kind of social butterfly character. And that she like, she does the hair, like even her main client like even says repeatedly like she does miracles with hair. I know she doesn't normally do weddings, but like she's so good, I can't believe it. And the reason that they mention that she doesn't do weddings, they think, is because of like the anxiety and it's like too much pressure. And that completely would make sense if then like the core thing you can't be is the main thing. You can do amazing hair, but you can't be that person. You can't be part of that group. You're not only like, it's not only never the bridesmaid, it's always the bridesmaid, never the bride. It's like not even the bridesmaid, it's at best
the flower girl.
Yeah, which her friends kind of make fun of her at, you know, when they all go to the bachelorette party later on.
And it's kind of what she says at the end, before the big twist, is I don't run. And yeah, it's that realization that she's never going to fit into this group. She's never going to be enough for this woman that she has this fixation on. It is both a sexual and a friend's desire. It seems like she doesn't know whether she wants to be friends with her or fuck her.
I would say she
wants to either be her or fuck her.
I would say she wants to be her or be her friend for sure. And maybe the last one, I would say that, I mean, this, we should say that this movie takes place in Kansas. So the idea that this girl might be a little sexually repressed is definitely there. There is definitely the tension, you could say, between her and the coffee shop girl, which definitely seems to be definitely like stronger on the coffee shop side of the girl than anything that that Claire is comfortable with. But also, David, before we talk any more about that, why don't you tell the good people at home who haven't seen this movie what The Stylist is about? Like, give us a little short synopsis, if you will.
Okay. A local hairstylist is having a constant identity crisis while also murdering her clients by scalping them and taking on their personality by wearing their hair still attached to the scalp. How does that sound?
I would say that is a pretty good beginning of it. And then I would say the second part is one of her clients, who she becomes particularly obsessed with over the film, asks her to do her hair at her wedding. And this seemingly simple request starts to unravel Claire at a kind of base level, and we as an audience stay with her and watch that happen.
Perfect.
Yeah, so I would say between the two. Yeah.
See, I do the shorter and you do the longer version, which cleans up my version.
There we go.
Two peas in a pod, Ken. Two peas in mm-hmm. a pod.
Indeed. Let's see here. Other things that we should mention about the film. We had mentioned the art direction and production design. That was actually by Sarah Sharp, who, another thing I mentioned, we just mentioned that this was a movie primarily shot around Kansas City and was is definitely like a Kansas production. But the other big contribution definitely came from the Midwest, from Chicago specifically, with Robert Patrick Stern, who is the DP, and Sarah Sharp, the production designer, came from there. And then from what I understand, their composer came from, I want to say, Wisconsin. I know their post, I believe, their post sound was done around the same area. I believe sound was from it was definitely like this whole movie was kind of, it was very much like a Midwest, Central, not Central America, Central United States production. And I love that this is a movie that in some of my research, I found out they made the short film, and then they were kind of looking around. Sorry,
this did start as a short film, didn't it? Like 2016?
Yeah, 2016. And it got some buzz. But from what I understand, it didn't, you know, bring anybody knocking down their door to make the film. So they decided to go out and kickstart this on their own. They asked for $46,500, and they ended up with $61,580. According to the Kickstarter. Now, I'm going to go ahead and assume they probably raised some other money on that. I wasn't able to find a full budget for this, but I will say this movie does not look like, for a movie that I'm going to assume was shot for around $100,000, $150,000 with post, kind of like all in with distribution and legal fees and all the bips and bobs. That's not, yeah, like I said, that's not a number I was able to find out, but just my experience making independent films. If you're starting off with $61,580, look, if they did this whole movie for that, holy, like I'm not worthy. Oh my God, Jill is the next. But I'm gonna guess
that alone is a reason enough for a production studio to hire her on.
Yeah, I mean, look, say what you want. This crew took a low range Mercedes amount of money and turned it into a movie that could compete visually with any high end movie out there that you're going to see in theaters. I would say also, speaking of high end visuals, something that we haven't talked about yet, but we should, Brian De Palma. This movie owes definitely a certain amount to Brian De Palma and Carrie. The score totally reminds me of Brian De Palma's, the guy who did the score for Carrie, which I want, his name's Pino something. I can't remember his name, but he is, he's fantastic. He also did some work on the Cabin Fever soundtrack. He did some work for David Lynch, if I remember correctly. I should have looked this up beforehand. I'm a bad podcast host. Yep. I'm very sorry. But there's...
We gotta shake the cobwebs loose a little bit.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, we've been gone for a little bit, so we're not quite as, you know, I might have pulled a muscle there. Anyway, Brian De Palma, I love the use of split screens that Jill used. I love the long lenses. I love the moments that they take of just slowing down the camera, over cranking things a little bit, and letting the characters get into the the emotion of cutting hair into the feelings that you get using the camera emotionally is something that so few first-time filmmakers or first-time feature filmmakers use so effectively. And again, Jill just knocked out of the park with this one.
Absolutely. And I think one of the other massive standouts in this film has to be, I think it's pronounced Nahara Townsend. Yeah. The lead actress, movies. And I thought she looked familiar. So she was in two movies that I've seen. And one of them was Me and You and Everyone We Know, which is a cute little indie flick from like 2005. So it was a while ago. But she was also in a horror film called Contracted. Did you ever see that one?
I did not see Contracted.
It's a crazy film where she plays the lead character, Samantha, who goes out on a date, sleeps with this guy, and then all of a sudden she starts pretty much like falling apart. And then it turns out that this guy has a really messed up venereal disease that you get from sleeping with corpses.
Oh, good. I mean, not yeah. good. I mean, good. Well, good. Yeah.
good for the actress for a stand-up performance. Bad for the character Samantha.
Yes, and I think that is a very good way.
Dead body STDs are certainly the ones to avoid.
Those are the worst kind of STDs.
The worst kind of STDs. I call them Halloween STDs.
Yeah. Ew. Don't sully the good name. Don't sully the good name of Halloween with STDs.
Of course. I who could imagine? Oh, mm-hmm. It's good to be back. But yeah, no, it's this is one of those films where like it took me a while to kind of like May. It took me a while to actually sit down and watch it. But that twist, man, that twist hits hard. It is a slow motion train wreck that you know what's going to happen. Not necessarily the way and manner in which it's going to happen, but you know nothing good is going to come of her attending this wedding.
Yeah, no, I mean, so one of the things I think that works so well in this is the very first time we see the stylist Claire kill. I don't entirely know if that happened. Like, there's just a little too much. What happened to the body? Isn't it convenient that no one's looking for this person? That there's like it's kind of weird to me that like there's no cop character in this movie. You know, I kept kind of expecting a police, you know, a sheriff to just come by.
I liked that there was no cop.
I have no problem with that at all. I just kind of kept expecting that. But then I think there's enough evidence that the middle killings, I think clearly happen, or at least more seemingly so. And there's this movie really does a great job of tippy-toeing back and forth on that line that people usually use to separate thrillers and horror movies. And I think this is a great movie of showing that you can use lots and lots of thriller sensibilities and make it much more of a personal story and much more about the characters, but still definitely it's a horror movie because there's like scalping. And while this movie's not wet, like from a movie standpoint, it's definitely like moist.
Just the concept of being scalped alone just gives me shivers. It is a, oh yeah, it is.
Yeah, but like this is a horror movie that definitely has like a character who kills. So I wouldn't call this movie a slasher movie. It doesn't really follow. So this is actually a great movie to talk about why it's so dumb to split these things into their genre tropes and pretend like there's hard and fast rules. Almost every single killing in this movie essentially happens with like a sharp-edged knife, which is definitely like the slasher thing to do. And there's definitely a body count in this movie, and there's definitely one killer, and like almost all of the victims are women. And that sounds like almost every slasher movie I've ever described, but like it doesn't have also a lot of the other elements that you completely, like, I wouldn't describe this movie as a slasher movie, despite the fact that it had, you know, something like Maniac and Texas Chainsaw Massacre are two of its like primary influences. It's not really that. It's much closer to, you know, a thriller, but you can't say that it's just a thriller. This is a real Schrodinger's burrito kind of a situation. And Schrodinger's burrito is, I believe I've explained this on the podcast before, but it doesn't sound like
have it's you? From your face. It does not sound familiar. Please.
Okay.
You know, just for your co-host, just for the sake of your co-host, maybe re-explain.
Okay. Schrodinger's
burrito.
Right. Schrodinger's cat is a idea in physics that you take a cat, you put it in a box, right? You put a radioactive thing next to the box, a really horribly radioactive thing next to the box, right? But the box is closed. Now, you leave that radioactive thing next to the box for a really long time. In theory, it has irradiated the cat and killed it. But you can't be sure until you open the box. So while the box is closed, the cat is both dead and alive because there's a chance the cat is alive. You don't know that till you open the box to find out. The cat could be dead. So it exists in this state between states until you
confirm. How does this become a burrito?
Okay. So next, I would say that if you were to ask the average, right, let me take a step back. The most popular Mexican food in the United States is Taco Bell. By every metric that I can find, if you ask people what their favorite Mexican food is, they'll say Taco Bell by the numbers. If you look by the amount of money that we spend on Mexican restaurants, Taco Bell wins. But if I would say you asked your average person of Mexican or Hispanic descent, would you count Taco Bell as Mexican food? The answer would be probably a no. Particularly, I think if that person is a chef, or takes pride in their cooking. Could be wrong, but that would just be my guess. So, does Taco Bell count as Mexican food? And I would say what you have there is a Schrodinger's burrito, because you can't say it's not Mexican food, but you can't say that it is. And so that is the same kind of thing I would say that you have with most movies. You have something like Silence of the Lambs, where people are like, well, that's a psychological thriller, not a horror movie. And I'm like, there's a cannibal in it who eats people. And they're like, well, Rosemary's Baby, nothing happens in that movie. And I was like, except the main character is raped by Satan. And if that's not horrific, then I don't know what counts as a horror movie. So again, with this, there's a lot of scalping. There's a lot of stabbing with weapons in particular. But also, it's not really a slasher movie. There's no chase scenes in this movie. There's no, you know what I mean? There's no stalking in this scene. Or if there is stalking, it's much more of the quiet standing outside for the thing that you have been waiting. You know, it is much more, I would say one of the scariest scenes I've ever seen in a movie, hands down, is in Michael Clayton. There is a scene where these two operators break into a man's house and they execute him. Like, but in the most, oh, this is how you kill somebody and make it look like it's an accident. And it's just the most clinical. These two guys just kind of walk in like, hep, doop-a-da-da-ba, and bring you over here and then lay you in bed. Okay, we put this needle in your neck. Okay, lay your head down here. Okay, go sleep. You're dead now. Bye, 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 bye. And they just like leave all calm. And it's just like, I'm never going to answer the door again. Wow. And that is in Michael Clayton, a legal drama by every other. And it's got one of the scariest scenes in it in all time.
Would you say the same thing goes for like Man Bites Dog?
Yes, another movie that is definitely a horror movie. Irreversible, another movie that is definitely a horror movie. The experience of watching it is horrific. But a lot of people would be like, I don't know, it's like a drama. And you'd be like, I mean, I don't know if we should.
Like a comedy sometimes.
Yeah, I don't know if we should. Yeah, I don't know if we should put that movie in the same category that we put in like Angels in the Outfield. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, it's... Oh,
seems like a bad time.
Oh yeah, absolutely. We're getting close to the to the minute mark, and or not the minute mark, where we're about like less than 10 minutes from when our little Zoom system that we use kicks us off. Which, by listeners, if you know a better outlet than Zoom for us to make these, please let us know, because Zoom asks for too much money. So we choose the free version. But I wanted to say that one thing that kind of goes on to your point is that all the victims in this are sympathetic. They're not mm-hmm. bad. They're very sympathetic, good people. They like, she doesn't go and kill the asshole friends of the bride because she knows that would lead back to her too easily. And so, but instead she kills the people that are nice to her.
Well, I don't know if she's afraid that it's going to lead back to her. I think that she's afraid that it's going to cancel the wedding.
Yeah, there's that too.
That would be my guess. Now, before we start wrapping things out here, the one thing I do want to mention for all of you would-be filmmakers out there, if you have, if you are still on the fence about seeing this movie, you're silly. One, but two, a great reason to watch this is a great movie for seeing how to take advantage of the things that you clearly have around you. Jill has been upfront about the fact that, you know, she has worked as a hairstylist herself. So I would be willing to bet that if you did some research, you would find out, oh, the salon in this is probably one that she used to work in. A lot of the other locations are also going to be that. They are going to be, I'm going to guess, the apartments of the people who were working here. Same thing with the exteriors. This is a movie that does a great job of using colored cinematography to make the image more interesting, despite them not having tons and tons of resources. There's a lot of beautiful uses of simple practical LED lights, just to add a little zhuzh or a little pizzazz in order to the back of the scene, a little bit of bokeh to the use of longer lenses. Using the camera and using those long lenses in order to create images that you wouldn't be able to see with your naked eye. There's so much with this that evokes the giallo genre, and they use smoke and atmosphere to add depth to all of these locations that sometimes are just basements, that are just side rooms, that are just, I would say the biggest, hardest location to get was probably that nightclub, would be my guess, from just a, like, you know, what you're dealing with on a logistical level. But this is a great movie to watch if you want to see how you can really get a ton of bang for your buck.
Absolutely. I think the only thing that I would change about this movie is the poster. Okay. Personally, I think the poster with that purple background and the font of the title, it looks like a Disney movie.
Well, you know what? If it gets one Disney princess to become a goth girl, I think then this was a success.
I was looking at it because when you sent me this, like, oh, we're going to watch this. And I was looking, it's like, what the fuck is this? Did Ken pick a children's fairy tale?
I did not. But speaking of fairy tales, our next movie, David, next week, what movie are we doing next week?
Ken, we are going to be watching not the remake, but the OG. Carrie.
Absolutely.
Stephen King's Carrie, baby.
Yeah,
we are hitting Halloween fast and hard.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I saw the inspiration that Jill clearly took from Brian, and I said, you know what, we need to do ourselves some Carrie. So that's what we're going to be doing next week. And until then, David, why don't you tell these good people at home where they can find us and you, and if you have any pluggables to plug.
Yes. Well, first off, you can find us at Shudder_show on Instagram, where I will be finally making some new posts about future upcoming projects that we're working on, and maybe try to be a little bit more socially active with you fellas now that things have calmed down a little bit. You can also follow me at _DW Marlowe, where I get up to my regular musings, everyday life, and the occasional carpentry projects and cute puppy pictures. Ken, what about you, good sir? Where can the people find you?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Ken Stachnik, KenStachnik. You can find us at Twitter at Shudder Show, and you can find us on email at, that was a terrible way of phrasing that, shuttershow@gmail.com. Other than that, I would say until next week, then thanks for listening. We'll see you again. And most importantly,
oh my God, Ken, go fuck yourself.
Night, everybody.
Love you.